Okay, hello. Welcome to the conference. I'm Donna Williams, and I'm going to be answering your questions. Starting here with Star Lazarer from Houston, you've asked me what's the best advice to give a mother who's just started their journey with someone called autism, someone who has autism. I would say the best advice is number one, throw out all the old stereotypes, and then throw out all the new ones. The new ones, whether they all think in pictures, whether they all need more stimulation, whether they are ABA is the best thing for everybody, whatever it may be, there is no one autism there, and therefore there is no one size fits all best approach to autism. Autism is a fruit salad. In every one of those fruit salads, there are different combinations. Because there are different combinations, what would have worked with one person with autism would be the complete opposite to what would have worked with somebody else. So, to give you a brief idea, Temple has found that ABA worked for her. She felt that she needed more stimulation. She was a good visual thinker. And so, let's compare that with me. I'm a person with visual agnosias who couldn't recognize whole objects, so everything was in bits. I never learned to think in pictures. I couldn't recognize pictures. I saw them in bits. I couldn't put concepts to pictures. I had to have the real object and be able to touch it, make noise out of it, move it. Even when I could learn a word and picture, I couldn't then apply it to real life. And so, what worked for Temple as a visual learner will not work for someone like me who had significant visual agnosias as well as the meaning deafness. Temple benefited from ABA. It is quite directly confrontational, it involves a lot of praise and attention. I, on the other hand, had extreme exposure anxiety. So, Temple, being a highly conscientious personality who enjoyed a sense of achievement, who likes people to give her praise and attention, she thrived. I'm the opposite. The more you focused on me, the more that you drew attention to what I did, the more you would cause me involuntary avoidance, diversion, and retaliation responses. So you'd actually make me more autistic by pouring on the praise, the attention, the intense one-to-one. I'm the kind of person that would have worked much better with, say, something like RDI, a more indirectly confrontational approach where you address the object, not the person, played hard to get, small doses, always leave them wanting more. And I've read a book called Exposure Anxiety, The Invisible Cage, where you can learn more about exposure anxiety. Temple talked about needing more stimulation, being understimulated. I was the exact opposite. I was unable to filter incoming information. I was storing whole television shows. I would store all the blah of all the people sitting together until they all sounded like a bunch of chickens clucking over each other. It would all tumble and fragment. My hearing would become really extreme, and everything would sound sped up, much louder, and I'd freak out. I needed very small doses of stimulation so that I could stop being so defensive and come out of that sort of feral cat clinging to the ceiling sort of state. So I hope that gives you an example where there's no such thing as asking one person with autism their best advice, unless they're someone who's worked with a wide range of people with autism so that they have a great comparison of where their own case fits in the wider context of the people with autism that they've directly worked with. So I would say, be your own expert. That person is your walking textbook. Be an anthropologist. Find out what's in their autism fruit salad, and get away from the word autism. Realize it's a label that's applied to people who don't understand what's in the fruit salad, and cut to the chase. Get to the fruit salad. I wrote a book called The Jumble Jigsaw, which is a guide to an insider's guide to autism fruit salads. So if you want to work out, does your child have agnosias, dyspraxia, alexithymia? Do they have comorbids? Are they dealing with gut immune metabolic disorders? Do they have speech apraxia? Do they have oral dyspraxia? Do they have an obsessive compulsive personality, or do they have OCD? Do they have autistic stims, or are they having Tourette's? All that sort of stuff. Then that's about exploring the fruit salad. That's what I'd suggest. Okay, Mary LaVale, you said many children with autism grow into being adults who are frustrated and angry. And you've asked me, what can people do working with children to help them express their feelings? How can we encourage their classmates to interact and understand them better? Number one, a lot of adults with autism who grow up to be frustrated and angry would have been those type of temperaments anyway. There are also adults with autism who've been through incredible injustices and don't walk around as a bunch of frustrated, angry, adrenaline-driven people. So I don't think we can apply that to everyone. I also think that we need to not confuse certain personalities with autism. If they happen to be quite aggressive, if they happen to be quite narcissistic and self-righteous or paranoid and on their high horse or whatever, we don't have to necessarily say that that's because they're autistic. That might just be their personality. I do think that people who've been through bullying, who have been misunderstood, whose families have fixated on their condition at the expense of not actually seeing the person, these people need counselling. They need, as adults, they need therapy to deal with things like post-traumatic stress from those sort of issues, attachment challenges, feelings of never having really been loved for who you are. I mean, those are really important things to address. And even if it's part of a misunderstanding, even if the parents had thought that they were doing the best by trying to deal with the condition, it doesn't mean that the person hasn't felt disregarded or secondary in the process. And I think that needs to be addressed. You've asked what you can do with children to help them express their feelings. It really depends. Some people will express their feelings through art, others through their special interests, be that engineering, be that science, be that collections. Some people through spirituality, some people with religion. I think that there are some people who will have alexithymia, and you should go and look that up on Wikipedia, alexithymia. And that's the difficulty processing what your feelings are and putting names to them. There'll be other people who might have schizoid personality disorder who are very afraid of intimacy and feel much safer being detached from their emotions. So there's a wide diversity. There's people with exposure anxiety who, the more that you look for their feelings, the more that you'll propel them into involuntary avoidance, diversion, and retaliation responses. And that by addressing objects, by using characterizations, by song, rather than trying to directly get to their feelings, you'll help them to free up through an indirectly confrontational approach. And if you want to know more about that, you can read Exposure Anxiety, The Invisible Cage. How do you encourage classmates to interact and understand people with autism better? I think a lot of classmates are quite hierarchical, and our hierarchy and a simultaneous sense of self and other go together. A lot of people with autism have a state of all self, no other, all other, no self. And so they don't easily develop that sense of hierarchy. Some will, and those are the ones who don't have that issue. But some will really struggle to develop that sense of hierarchy. And when people have that hierarchy, they worry about point scoring and who's going to make them look good and who's going to make them look worse. And I think that just teaching children in general to enjoy sensory experiences, to enjoy textures, smells, to enjoy rhythms, to enjoy sound patterns, to enjoy colour, to enjoy movement, that can help them to better understand a world without meaning. It can help them to understand that there's more to life than just speaking and the world of one word, one meaning. Or the world of recognizing what you see. that you can still enjoy the textures, the shapes, the forms, the sounds, the smells, even if you can't recognize what you see. So enjoying music together, enjoying art together, enjoying movement like trampolining, swinging, spinning, cycling, skating, the kind of things that are still left when you have some of those other difficulties. And if they understand those, maybe they'll have a bit of a related world. But certainly segregation doesn't help. And the more that we keep people with autism away from non-autistic environments, we're just not going to give people any experience of someone they've liked who had autism, and then they're not going to really easily accept the adults. Okay, Leanne, you're from Pottstown, and you've asked me, would I want to know the strategies to help with agnosias, or would I want to take the chemicals, whatever that may be, that could help my brain build connections to overcome agnosias? And you say you've asked this because you've heard that adults with disabilities say they don't want to fix, because their disability has made them who they are. You've said that your thought is, what about the young children who've not yet created themselves through their experiences? And you've asked, would agnosias be something that I see as being able to be fixed? You've said, sorry to use that term, but you don't like to talk about fixing kids. But if you can provide the brain with something that's missing or insufficient for functioning, also things like mental illness, learning disabilities, you've asked, do I see that as a viable option to helping children with autism be successful? People who say that they fully embrace their disability and it's completely made them who they are, well, I think that that's their experience and they can't apply it to all people. I mean, would they say that incontinence has really made their life, made them who they are, and they feel good about it, and they wouldn't do anything to change incontinence? Because incontinence can be part of a body agnosia, where you can't work out where the muscles are, or you can't easily process the sensations or tell them from emotions or other body messages. I wouldn't say that just because someone who hasn't had those experiences fully embraces their label, that someone with that doesn't have a right to look for answers. Has somebody who has had difficulty pronouncing speech and then got speech therapy and then acquired speech and can make themselves understood, are they in the same position as someone who spent 10 years being meaning deaf, feeling like a deaf person in a hearing world who's never been provided with fluent signing, who's walking around being, feeling on the outer as people are sharing the one word, one meaning system? Do I think that they should just be nice and cute and very sweet and spend the rest of their life repeating whole TV shows and advertising because they've never learned the one word, one meaning system? No, I don't think that's fair. I think that's like saying just because one person had late speech or oral dyspraxia and poor pronunciation, or was selectively mute until they were 4 or 6, or had learned helplessness because their sister did all their speaking for them, that therefore means the same as people with speech aphasia or with severe verbal agnosias. I don't think it's the same thing, and I don't think people should project their reality onto other people just because they have a shared label. We all should have a right to come to our experiences and how we identify or don't identify in our own way. Someone who's able to fluently think in pictures and really enjoys that experience, good luck to them, because 65% of the general population think visually. And if a percentage of people with autism do so as well, that's really great. If they learn to do it exceptionally, that's fine for them. It's wonderful. If you have visual agnosias and you see things in bits, like you've never seen a whole cat, you've seen the ears, the tail, the feet, the fur, never seen a whole cat. And then you see a picture of a cat and you can rote learn that you say the sound cat when you see the picture of the cat, and you can't then see the real cat and say cat, you say fush or brrk, because it says fush when you pat it, fush, 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 or brrk as it's going past you. I don't think that's really going to make your life easy. It's not going to help you to easily interact with people or to piece together what you need to become someone who can use functional communication through typing or speech. So if you haven't been through that experience, you don't have a right to project onto those who are still dealing with it whether or not they should deeply embrace that reality and feel deep pride and completely identify with it. You know, you shouldn't project onto those people that they're going to be fantastic visual thinkers and they're all going to have a wonderful life and become really great at anything they choose to be, because they might really have very significant disabilities that are going to really limit their ability to manage their own life. They probably will have carers for a significant amount of their life or have reduced independence if you don't teach them the strategies that are going to help them to manage meaning deafness, meaning blindness, disconnectedness from body. There are some things that people can do. You talk about taking the chemicals. L-glutamine significantly reduced my visual and verbal and body agnosias. It gave me a simultaneous sense of self and other instead of being all self, no other, all other, no self. It moved me from being 50% meaning deaf to only 30% meaning deaf. And before that, in childhood, nutritional supplements and eating whole meals moved me from being 90% meaning deaf to only 50%. So would I change that? Would I take that away because it made me less autistic? No. Am I sorry that I got treatment for gut immune metabolic disorders that dramatically improved my information processing? No. Would I decide to go and be a person who's still ill from gut immune metabolic disorders so that I can have the joy of being more autistic? Go drop on your head. Would I like to be someone who's still gripped with constant involuntary avoidance, diversion, retaliation responses caused by exposure anxiety? No. How about you go live with that gut that's gripped with dread and the imprisonment of finding that you walk away from the people you want to look at, that you tune out the people you wanted to say hello to, that you pull away from the hug you really wish that you could take just so that you don't pinch or shove the person, because it's not a delicious, delightful, celebratory reality. It's one that, for me, increased agoraphobia, made me feel unsafe in my own body, made me feel alien to people, and caused me to have to use strategies where I wouldn't do as myself, by myself, or for myself in order to get around the involuntary avoidance, diversion, retaliation responses. And that's imprisoning. So who has a right to tell me that I should deeply love that as part of my autism? If I find that low-dose medication helps me reduce bipolar, OCD, Tourette's, and exposure anxiety so that I have more control over my body, my responses, I have more time to process what's coming in, who has a right to tell me that I should not want to be less autistic? Autistic is just a word. You can glorify it all you like. You can wrap it in a million Einsteins. And it doesn't change the fact that autistic is just a word for a fruit salad. And everyone's fruit salad's different. I really value some things that my autism taught me. It taught me resilience. It taught me the really positive experiences that can come out of struggle. It taught me a lot of spiritual lessons and to be patient with the disabilities that other people have. I don't regret any of those journeys because those have made me who I am. But I still feel that part of that journey was in reducing the degree of my autism. And I embrace that journey too. And I guess the bottom line is that we all have a right to make that own journey. No one has a right to dictate any one-size-fits-all way of identifying with your disability or choosing to see that you are a person with a condition and that there are aspects of your personality, of your history, of your inheritance, of your relatedness that aren't 100% only about your autism. And that's where I'm at with that. So I guess I'm neither a culturalist nor a curist. I'm a realist. Thank you. Okay, Smiley Jesu Priya, you're from Kuala Lumpur, and you've asked me what type of agnosias will affect the majority of people with autism, and what are the cognitive strategies that people can use to improve these. There are three main types of agnosias that people with autism may be affected by. Those with Asperger's, the most common one is social emotional agnosia, which is difficulty reading facial expression, body language, and intonation. Those people can formally learn those things, so watching DVDs or YouTube clips that teach facial expression, body language, intonation can give them a social advantage that they would otherwise not have. And a lot of people, about 30% of people on the autism spectrum, will be face blind. Those people will struggle to recognize people when they've changed their hair, changed their jacket, or are seen in an unfamiliar place. Those who are severely face blind may not even recognize their own mirror reflection. And as a result of that, they may really struggle in the playground because people are not sitting in the same place. And so people who look similar end up really interchangeable, and that can become a really stressful experience. So I definitely think that the right to befriend a mirror can be really important in retaining a feeling of respect and relatedness in people with severe face blindness. And they'll often watch you in the mirror. And people with visual agnosias who see the world in bits, ironically, when they look in a mirror, it reduces the level of incoming information. And so they can often see the world more as a whole in a mirror reflection than they can in real life, or directly. People with visual fragmentation who see the part and lose the whole, often with tinted lenses, will cut out a certain amount of incoming information and give their brain more time to process what's left. And often brown sunglasses will do the job. Lowering salicylate levels, I've found, has improved people's ability to see things as a whole and keep up with what they're hearing. So if they are salicylate intolerant, then reducing the level of high salicylates can improve things. Some people are eating fluoride toothpaste, and the fluoride is not, you're not, it's not recommended for children under the age of six, toothpaste, because they can swallow it. And when children do swallow it, fluoride is sold commercially as a rat poison. It strips the lining of the gut so that the rat dies. And so when children with autism eat fluoride, they are stripping the lining of their own digestive tract. And one of the consequences is high fluoride toxicity dramatically raises the toxicity of salicylates. So just by changing to a non-fluoride toothpaste, there are people who will become significantly less agnosic if that's their issue. People with celiac, whose brain is being starved, or gluten intolerance, whose brain's being starved caused by the damage to the bowel from eating gluten, can begin to reverse some of that and get better information processing by addressing that. Similar for me, I am significantly more meaning deaf, with significantly more visual fragmentation when eating cow's milk products because I'm casein intolerant. I'm also gluten intolerant, but because I have an IgA deficiency, I have, like most people with IgA deficiency, a false negative to celiac tests, but the urine analysis shows I still can't digest gluten, so that's a useful thing to know. The cognitive strategies for verbal agnosias, the meaning deafness, include gestural signing, communication via objects, slowed speech, slowing speech, speaking in bullet points, simplifying what you're saying. And if you've got people who've got auditory verbal agnosia, that's the one where external noises jumble in with speech. So by closing the window to the traffic noise, turning off the fan and the air conditioning, the people can often keep up better with speech. With visual agnosias, you really have to learn the world through your hands. So understand that these are people who probably won't become visual thinkers. Even if they are drawn to movement and cartoons, it doesn't mean that they make easy sense of pictures or relate pictures back to speech. Even if they can rote learn a picture and the sound of the word cat, for example, doesn't mean that they are going to easily relate the picture of the cat to the physical cat. So through patting the physical cat and the use of the word cat joined to the texture and the patting, then they can learn the word. And so discovery learning, hands-on learning, hand-over-hand modelling are really important for people with visual agnosias. Body agnosias, you have a lot of stuff where you have to teach people modulation. What is a strong touch? What is a soft touch? What is warm? What is cold? What is soothing? What is painful? How to feel something in two different parts of your body? Where to find the muscles to push to go to the toilet? And by blowing on the back of your hand, you can find those muscles, for example. I have a video over on autismhangout.com, and it's one where people can learn more about the different types of agnosias, and I also do mention a lot of the strategies that you can use. Those are also mentioned in books like The Jumbled Jigsaw and Autism, an Inside-Out Approach. Okay, Smiley Jasupriya from Kuala Lumpur, you also sent in the question, how will person overcome sensory issues in real life situations? How did I develop social interaction skills, and what are the difficult situations for autistic children? How do I manage those? It's a huge question. Okay, sensory issues. Let's distinguish sensory hypersensitivity from agnosias. There are people who will have sensory hypersensitivity because they're lacking B vitamins, or because they've got dyspraxia and they aren't easily able to distinguish sensory information one from another, or they might have difficulty just being able to tolerate different degrees of sensory input. And some people are more sensorily hypersensitive than others, and that includes non-autistic people. Okay, social interaction skills are really hard when you're meaning deaf. So helping people to join meaning to incoming speech is really important. And that can mean things like labelling everything in your house so that they can link written words to real experiences. It might mean things like gestural signing, the use of representational objects to track thought when you can't internally mentalise or internally visualise thought. Social interaction is really difficult when you can't hold on to a simultaneous sense of yourself and other. And so working in parallel and putting the focus on objects is a much more successful way of interacting socially than trying to teach people to play in a directly interactive way, a directly confrontational way. So difficult situations, there's just way too many. I guess a lot of the difficulties that I had was because people didn't understand meaning deafness, and they didn't know to slow their speech, to use bullet points, to get objects to help me track what they're saying, to use gestures to help me keep up with the meaning. They didn't know about turning off the overhead lights to reduce incoming visual information so I might see the room more cohesively. They didn't know about introducing themselves when they came back into a different room or had changed their coat. They didn't know about maintaining some kind of consistency visually so that they appeared to be the same person. They didn't know about using a particular song or some way of recognizing them that was easy so that I could warm up to them more quickly. That sort of stuff. Okay, Lisa, you're from Seaside Park in New Jersey, and you've asked me here, what are the specific approaches I'd suggest to help elementary school age children overcome meaning deafness? I think I've pretty much mentioned these already. Gestural signing is not like Makaton, and it's not really like deaf signing either. It's closest to home sign. So if you go and look up home sign, you get an idea. Makaton requires that you learn certain signs and then apply them to situations. So their sign for apple, for example, is pinch your cheek. And in gestural signing, that just means pinch your cheek. So in gestural signing, if you want to do apple, you would have your hand around something the size of an apple and bite into it as if you were biting off a chunk of the apple. In Makaton, toilet is the letter T, whereas in gestural signing, toilet is the gesture of taking your trousers down or taking your pants down, because that's pretty common to when you're going to the toilet. So gestural signing is much more related to the direct experiences, the physical shape, or the movement that's related to the words. And I guess the other side of it is representational objects. So if you were talking to someone who's meaning deaf about today we're going to the park, and when we're there we're going to be collecting leaves, and then we're going to get on the bus and we're going to come home, you really would have to use a gesture for today, that you're not talking about tomorrow. You're not talking about yesterday, you're talking about today. And for me, I use a gesture that's, it's close to the deaf sign for now. Today, we, which to me is like a circle that includes everybody, we are going, and go is like a sign of moving through space, to the park, and then I draw a square meaning location. And then if we're going to play on the swings, I do the swinging action with my hands. If we're doing the slide, I'd show the slide. If we were going to then get on the bus, I'd do the climbing, and then I'd do the driver for the bus. That sort of stuff. So if I didn't use gesture, I would at least use objects to indicate where we're moving and when we're finished and where we're going and that sort of stuff. Because with meaning deafness, when you move on to the next part, you lose the last part unless you're able to track it with objects. So the resources, main resources, would be Jumble Jigsaw, Autism and Inside Out Approach, and the video that's on the Autism Hangout. I did one on agnosias that's there. Okay. You've said here, somebody said, my 12-year-old son is verbal but struggles to respond to questions. I know he has all the vocabulary knowledge, but he can't process it. Any suggestions to help him? Also, his teachers keep saying that he lacks focus and becomes easily distracted in the classroom. Any strategies you can give teachers to improve his attention? Thanks so much. So you said he is verbal but struggles to respond to questions. He has all the vocabulary but cannot process it. So we're not necessarily talking about meaning deafness here. So if he had exposure anxiety, for example, when they ask him a question, he would go into involuntary avoidance, diversions, and retaliation responses. So they'd actually be shutting him down by directly asking him questions. If that was the case, what you'd do is you would give him multiple choice. So all he has to do is tick the box rather than come up with the answers. Or you would use statements to trigger answers. And they would be yes, no statements, like, you know, you'd say you prefer blue, you prefer yellow, you prefer neither. And if he generally, people will have a little physical giveaway that says that's their reality, and that one will only tend to trigger when you get the right thing. And then you can say, on a scale of 0 to 10, you like this a 5, you like this less than a 5, you like this more than a 5, that sort of thing. If you want to know about that strategy, you can find it in a book called Like Colour to the Blind. But if you want to know about exposure anxiety, you'll find that in a book called Exposure Anxiety, The Invisible Cage. Okay, you've said here, my 34-month-old, this is Paula from Albany in New York. My 34-month-old daughter has Asperger's. She's never able to sit down and listen to stories, no matter how interesting the story is at home or in the library. She's either jumping around or flaps the books to herself. She doesn't listen to directions. She doesn't follow the common rules. She screams when things are not exactly her own way. What should I do? Okay, so the part last part, she screams when things are not exactly her own way. Sounds more like personality than agnosias. So I think you need to distinguish that from autism. That's really important. There are people who are very bolshy and they are very controlling and they're all about their rights and that's personality. So go to ptypes.com and learn about personality and the extremes of it and distinguish it from autism. But where you're talking about inability to listen to stories, no matter how interesting, I hated hearing stories. The only time I liked it was to rote learn how to reel it back off. But here, trying to understand it with meaning, even if they pointed at the pictures, they just pointed a few bits in the picture, and I couldn't understand the whole picture. And I certainly couldn't link it back to the fluent blah, blah, blah. I would see there was a swing or there was Mary, but I had no idea of the rest of what was in the story. So what I found in schools was that when I had one person read the book, pointing to each word as they read it, and the other person using fluent gestural signing and characterizations, at the end of the story, the children were still sitting there. And if you went to put the book away, they'd go and get the book and bring it back and try and make you do it again. In other words, try to turn the reading of a book into a play, into a pantomime. So if somebody was reading, for example, and then the bear came in and said, "Get off my chair," I wouldn't go quack, 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 blah, blah, blah. I would say, and then I'd do a sign for, and then the bear. And now I've got, my paws up showing that I'm a bear. The bear came in and then wagged his finger and said, "Get off," showing the sign for off, "by," showing the sign for my ownership, "chair," and for chair there's the demonstration of the shape of the chair and the cushion. Yeah. So the bear's come in and said, "Get off my chair." Pretty much, I would characterize and use gestural signing throughout the whole story. I generally stick to stories that have only one or two characters because it gets very complicated to use gestural signing or representational objects to track a very multifaceted story. But just getting someone interested in actually listening to stories, that's probably a really good way. And I hope that you're able to do that. I did do a DVD which was called Battling with Books, and I'm hoping to get that up on Autism Hangout soon so that you can have a look at what those strategies were. Okay, and I've got one here from Bonnie from Baltimore. How can we facilitate learning body image in a 12-year-old? He's not aware of how much space his body takes up and does not equate that if you swing something, it'll contact someone else. First thing, Bonnie, is there's a difference between body agnosias and something that some studies recently found about problems with the amygdala that some people are unable to perceive personal space. And as such, they'll get really in people's faces and they get no fear of being really up close. And so no amount of trying to intimidate them back into their own space will work. I found that for these people, teaching them to put their arm out to measure an arm's length between them and the other person so that they can know that that's what's acceptable. The thing about swinging something will have contact with someone else. I remember when I was 11 and I was trying to play cricket, being taught cricket, and they go, "Drop the bat, drop the bat." And I threw the bat and it hit someone in the head. And everyone was really upset at me. And basically, I couldn't perceive myself and another person at the same time. I was all self, no other, or all other, no self. And I certainly couldn't perceive that if I let go of a bat, that it could fly through space and hit someone else, because I didn't have internal mentalizing. I couldn't internally visualize anything. But through playing it out through objects and showing an object, hitting something, and then they've let the bat go, and then the bat hit the other person, Oh no! Well, then I could envision that if I was holding the bat and then I let the bat go, then I could imagine that it could hit another person. But I could never have imagined that just from you telling me. And I could never have imagined that with internally mentalizing it or visualizing it, because I had visual agnosias. So I couldn't visually imagine anything. You'd just go, now just imagine this. And I couldn't imagine it. So you have to actually show it to me through modeling it. And modeling it through objects or getting actors to do it for me so that I could then imagine that if I did it, what's the next step? Oh no, it will hit somebody. So, mirror reflection is another way that people who don't get good body feedback can use mirror reflection to then track what the body does and things like consequences. So, in a nutshell, if you're meaning deaf, your eyes become your ears. If you're meaning blind, your hands become your eyes. If you have body agnosias, then the mirror, the visual tracking, becomes your body feedback. So I hope that that's been useful to the people who are listening in to my answers here at the conference. Thank you for having me, and I hope that that's been of use to you. You can find a lot more information at donnawilliams.net. And when you go there, there are articles there. There's also a section which is interactive, and that will lead you through to my blog. And on my blog, you'll find a lot of articles about agnosias. And I've written widely about a whole range of things. I have 9 published books with Jessica Kingsley Publishers, which can all be found on my website. I also have another book that it is not with Jessica Kingsley. All of my books can be found on my website, and several of them do address agnosias, particularly the Jumble Jigsaw and Autism and Inside Out approach. But also the book Autism and Sensing addresses what the world is like for those who struggle to put meaning to incoming information and how they rely on the system of sensing, of mapping pattern and theme and feel when they can't easily rely on interpretive meaning. So I hope that's been useful to you, and thank you for having me. Bye.